Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers over the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Our speaker this time is Wallace Stegner. During his 50-plus year career, Stegner wrote more than 30 books and numerous short stories that won him millions of readers, as well as a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize. But his legacy is not purely literary. He became involved in the conservation movement as early as 1950, and in 1960, Stegner wrote The Wilderness Letter, which became the introduction to the National Wilderness Preservation System Bill in 1964. Stegner was also a powerful lecturer and teacher. Most famously, Stegner founded the Creative Writing Program at Stanford University in 1946. His students included Larry McMurtry, Wendell Berry, and Oregon's own Raymond Carver and John Daniel. Join us now for Wallace Stegner, here in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1990.
Thank you, thank you. Good evening, thank you very much. It's nice to be in Portland, even though I have been here once before. Also, I understand that this is a night of mourning because the Blazers just lost. And I don't know whether what I'm going to say will be a consolation or not, because I'm going to talk about something a long way from the Blazers. And I may talk a little erratically and ruminatively about the art of fiction, which is one of the few things I think I know a little bit about. So I might as well begin. Once when I was young and trying to learn to write, I used to study the manuals. You know, they used to have all of these manuals, how to do this and how to write, hoping that there was a way and that it could be learned. I remember once going to a lecture entitled, How to Write a Short Story, Though Ignorant. Knowing my own ignorance, though not especially humble about it even then, I thought that a humorous man who started from right where I was might be able to teach me something. That was a vain hope. The ignorance in the man's title was a come-on. He knew exactly how to write a short story. He had a bottle into which he could pour any mixture. And over the years, he'd confirmed his confidence in the method by selling the whole product of his bottling works to the Saturday Evening Post for high prices. For him, a story was made, not born or discovered or achieved. And if it began as something discovered in life, it was not a story until it had been tugged and pulled into a pattern, to fit a pattern. Every story for him began with a carefully constructed situation with the seeds of conflict in it. Two men were rivals for a girl or a gold mine or a corporation. They were evenly matched. And only the most tenuous and sometimes deceptive clues told a reader which was the good guy and which was the bad guy. They didn't seem that much different. First one held the advantage, then the other. Seesaw game. But a smart writer dropped hints, suggesting that the one who was really going to lose looked more like the winner, just for suspense. And at the point of greatest complication, it should seem that the bad guy, who was by now beginning to be suspected and disliked, would win. And then, as swiftly and economically and plausibly as possible, something was introduced or revealed that turned things around. The bad guy went under, the good guy came out on top, as in Cinderella and many other basic plots that could be looked up in Pulte's 36 dramatic situations. By the time the denouement was reached, a reader would realize that he had been hoping all the time for this solution that now seemed inevitable. Since I sought instruction from that ignorant lecturer, I've written a few dozen short stories and a dozen or more novels, and I'm willing to grant that his method of the plotted story, of the complication resolved, which is as old as storytelling itself and about as much in fashion as Oxford bags, can still be effective and artful in the right hands and the right circumstances and when informed with real passion. Conflict still is the essence of drama, no matter how we attenuate it or etherealize it or cover it up. Winning and losing, as demonstrated tonight, are still endings that people care about. And last-minute winnings and endings are the most dramatic and satisfying of all, as when a week or so ago Stanford scored 9 points in the last 12 seconds of play. That one was one that people cared about. Well, you do care. The ordinary pattern of a story in the old-fashioned way used to be reversal of expectation. Lead a reader to think something is going to happen and turn it on its head and surprise him a little. The movies and the TV prove that every day. And even stories that seem to avoid entirely the calculation and the manipulation implicit in reversals can be seen, when you look at all closely, to be still reversals. If you look at, take a John Cheever story, Torch Song, in which you are shown a young girl from the Middle West coming to New York. She looks like everybody's friend and companion. She helps people out. She's always sitting by bedsides. You go through her whole career until he turns the last page and shows you necrophilia. She's in love with death. She's in love with sickness. That's a reversal of what you have thought of her all along, and yet when you know it, it's the way the story has to go. Or take another Cheever, The Swimmer, which looks like a well-to-do suburbanite going home through swimming pools and cocktail parties to his well-cared-for house. And at the last page, he meets a locked door. He's closed out. His career is ended. He has just been walking toward, essentially, his death through the whole story. Or take one like William Faulkner's A Rose for Emily, where we're told a story of about 20 years of old Emily, who has lived in a shut-up house behind drawn blinds. There have been episodes when strange odors came around, and the neighbors went around surreptitiously throwing lime at the foundations, thinking some skunk had got under the house and died or something. It turns out that Emily, who was engaged to some Yankee contractor after the Civil War, was abandoned, ditched by this man who disappeared, and that's when she disappeared into her house behind the drawn blinds. When she dies, they enter her house finally. You know this story, undoubtedly. And find in her bedroom the corpse of the contractor melted into the bed. It's been there ever since she closed up the house. And in the pillow beside it, the dent of another head. So Emily has not only murdered her faithless lover, but has slept with his corpse. You think, well, all right, that's pretty good Faulkner touch. But then you look more closely, and in the last line you see in that dent in the pillow beside the corpse, an iron gray hair. She's not only slept with his corpse, but she's been sleeping with it ever since for 20 years. And that's an extra little touch, you know, an extra kicker to reverse your expectation a little bit. And also to add an incomparably Faulknerian Gothic detail and give you some notion of a kind of intransigent Southern pride, which is really what the theme of that story is about. Listening to that lecture long ago, I didn't grant any validity to all of his traditional formulas and reversals. I was offended that he tried to sell me that old routine carpentry of storytelling. Though I might have granted that conflict was still the essence of drama, I disliked the contrivance and manipulation that conflict seemed to demand. For in the 1920s, I was a modern young man, I guess. And I had read Chekhov and Kafka and Hemingway, Mansfield and Joyce, and who had all dispensed with formula plots and found better ways. In these postmodernist years, I suppose the ways they found may look commonplace or even anachronistic, but in the 20s, believe me, they were revelation. In place of winnings and losings, they all dealt in nuances, epiphanies, illuminations. Often nobody won and nobody lost. Often there was no resolution, only a kind of revealing, sometimes sudden, sometimes, as in Chekhov, as gradual as a very slow dawn. And sometimes, as in Kafka, stories never ended at all. They just raveled away like dreams that you lose even while you try to hang on to them. My distaste for that lecturer stemmed partly from the fact that he was commercial, and I was above that. Partly from his carpenter's rule method, but most of all, I finally understood from the fact that he had nothing but method. He wrote from an unvarying blueprint. He pulled prepackaged frivolous surprises out of his sleeve to elicit a gee whiz response from the reader. There was no fire in his belly. There was no passion or vision or doubt in his mind, no penetration or challenge in what he wrote. He illuminated nothing. He opened no windows. He left no worm of wonder working in his reader's mind. He had nothing to say, in other words, and nothing to ask beyond the questions to which he had just pre-cooked the answers. He was a mechanic. The writers I admire and still admire were not carpenters, but more like sculptors. Their art was and is a real probing of real and troubling human confusions. They spurned replicas. They despised commercialized entertainment. They were after the mystery implicit in the stone. By now, I'm prepared to guess that any method that lets a reader lay bare any moment of that mystery is legitimate. Skill is whatever works. Different skills will work for different writers and upon different readers. But any skill must, I think, work toward something. We're not creating machines that are going to do nothing but run. They got to make something. Moreover, the eye, I think, is not a copier. It must add something to what it sees. The late Donald Barthelme, who wrote very, very short stories, confessed that he was in love with fragments, and he was probably speaking his mind pretty truly. But he forgot to say that he adds something to his fragments, and that the best of them are more than fragments, they're illuminations. One page or 600, a fiction is more than a well-carpentered entertainment. It's also more than the mirror in the roadway that Stendhal said it was. Because a good writer isn't really a mirror. He's a lens. One mirror is like another mirror, a mechanical reflector. But a lens may be anything from what you have in your instamatic to what makes you handle your Hasselblad with reverence. Ultimately, I think there's no escaping the fact that fiction is only as good as the person who makes it. It sees only with the clarity that he's capable of, and it perpetuates all of his astigmatisms. It should make me nervous, and it does, to talk about my own writing when both the writing I talk about and the things I say about it may be revealing my own astigmatisms of which I'm unaware. It sounds almost as if I were afraid of being found out, as if there are secrets in there, that I'm disguising myself behind a mask in order to make statements that are my own statements. Or else perhaps that my novels are all Romana Clay or confessions or something of the kind, and that there are keys to them which should not be revealed. All of which I think is somewhat irritating and somewhat nonsensical. No novel even one that's meant to be autobiographical, can be read in so naively literal a fashion as that. Writers are a little more cunning than their credulous readers suppose. We're all practiced shapeshifters and ventriloquists. We can assume shapes and speak in voices not our own. We all have to have, in some degree, what Keats called negative capability, that capacity to inhabit a skin not your own. What Shakespeare, for instance, had in incomparable degrees. Nobody has ever had it more. He could speak with total persuasiveness out of the mouth of Hotspur or Shylock, Iago or Hamlet or Juliet. Faulkner, I think, too, had it supremely. You couldn't possibly make any kind of autobiographical reconstruction of Faulkner's life from his fictions, any more than you can reconstruct Shakespeare, as people have always tried to do ever since he died, from his plays. Almost all of us have some of that capacity. Some don't use it, or use it very little. If you look at the fictions of, well, for three, Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe, the first Thomas Wolfe, Catherine Ann Porter, you keep encountering these characters who haunt the thing, like recurring clones of their authors. The differences between those extremes of objectivity and subjectivity are obvious, but not really critical. Some writers want to expose themselves, some want to hide themselves, some want to efface themselves. Some who appear to expose themselves are distorting themselves for sneaky reasons of their own. There's more than one way to impose order on your personal chaos. But since good writers write what is important to them, they're bound to be in there somewhere, as participants, or as observers, or as ombudsmen, or as something. I think, if you think about it, you will recall that there are not so many autobiographies by fiction writers. Unlike soldiers or statesmen, they don't get to a certain age and feel that they have to rush to put it all down for posterity. The reason may be that most fiction writers have already written their autobiographies piecemeal, overtly or covertly, and they go on doing so every working day. Somebody said to me once, "I envy you. How nice it must be to able to write your life instead of having to live it." He had it a little bit wrong. It isn't a substitution, it's a succession. You live it first and then you write it. Once you have written it, though, or parts of it, even in disguised or modulated form, you find that you just about used it up as autobiographical principle. If there is a sense in which every piece of fiction is autobiographical, it's just as true, I think, that every autobiography is to some extent a fiction. A couple of years ago, I had the disturbing experience of having to write a short biography for a reference book. And while I was doing it, I noticed three things. One was the difficulty of getting my precious life into 10,000 words. It bothered me a great deal. The second was that I constantly had the feeling that I'd written all this before. And the third was that on every page, I had to restrain myself to keep from fixing it. I went around and around myself like a fussy mother fixing her 15-year-old up for her first formal dance. So I was running a kind of sack race, leg-bound by these facts that I didn't want to be leg-bound by. Whereas when I had rendered some of that same experience earlier as fiction, I could be as cavalier with it as I wanted to, because where the fiction called for some kind of change, I could make it. I wasn't writing history. In the interest of general truthfulness, I wanted all this to be true, but I could fix it to be truer than it had been in fact. In an autobiography, I couldn't. And I don't know which version is truer when you come right down to it. You know? One's, they're different, but they're both attempts of a kind at truth. As an example of how close fiction and autobiography sometimes are, you might know Philip Roth, one of his Zuckerman books called The Facts, which is not the facts at all. The book purports to give the true dope on the life of Philip Roth, as distinguished from the life of his stooge, Zuckerman. But in The Facts, Zuckerman, a fiction, enters unbidden, or not quite unbidden, really invited when it comes down to that. And from the sidelines, he emits these challenges and Bronx cheers and snorts of disdain, while his author goes through the charade of telling his life story. The Facts is as surely a novel posing as an autobiography as Zuckerman Unbound is an autobiography masquerading as a novel. In his Education, Henry Adams wrote, "Chaos is the law of nature. Order is the dream of man." Both fiction and autobiography attempt, it seems to me, to impose order upon the only life that any of us knows, which is our own. Once at a literary meeting, I heard someone ask John Cheever why he wrote one of those author-felling questions that come from the audience sometimes. But he replied without hesitation, "To try to make sense of my life," which is the best answer I could think of. You know? The life we all live is to many degrees and in many ways amateurish and accidental. It begins in accident and proceeds by trial and error toward dubious ends. That's the law of nature. The dream of man won't accept what nature hands us. We have to tinker with it the way I was tinkering with my autobiography, trying to give it purpose, direction, and meaning. Or if you're of another set of mind, trying to prove that it doesn't have any purpose, set, or meaning. Either way, we can't leave it alone. The unexamined life, as the wise Greek said, is not worth living. We have to examine it, if only to persuade ourselves that we matter and are in control, or that we at least are aware of what's being done to us. Autobiography and fiction are variant means to the same end. And neither one should be wrapped in any straitjacket of method. The method becomes paramount only when it's an end in itself and begins to impose its structure on the matter, when it's a formula for arriving at prepackaged answers and evading the real questions. The guts of any significant fiction or autobiography, I think, is an anguished question. The true art of fiction, in which I include autobiography, involves putting that question within a plausible context of order. When we invent fictional characters, that's when we invent gods. We generally invent them in our own image. And in any case, we create the unknown out of the materials of the known. The worlds that novelists create, even those fantasy worlds of forward or backward time or space, are made out of the details of the world we know. Try to think of a new color, for instance. Invention and method have to fuse. The writer may play games of distortion, double exposure, deliberately blurred focus. He may focus upon himself, focusing, as John Barth and others have done when they try to write fiction out of the act of writing fiction, make a story out of writing a story. And ingenious as that often is, it gets a little Alexandrian for my taste, I guess. I do believe the real world exists. and that literature is the imitation of life. And I like to keep my categories at least recognizable. Sleight of hand, however clever, is not enough. And distortion can be a method with real dangers in it, I think. Thus, the admirable artist Flannery O'Connor said that she dealt in the grotesque because when dealing with the hard of hearing, one had to shout. That remark rather offends me as a reader. I don't think I'm hard of hearing. And anyway, with the truly deaf, shouting doesn't help. It only confuses and annoys and leads to arguments. I like O'Connor's stories, which kind of rise out of her unconscious, better than her justification of them, because her justification of them seems to me doctrinaire. Having no such spiritual convictions as she had, I have to make do with spiritual uncertainties. And having, besides, a temperamental aversion to the hyperboles of distortion, I have had to clarify the only life I know, the only way I know how. My life challenged me to make sense of it, and I made fictions. But I wanted the fictions to be recognizable and true to the ordinary perception, not necessarily to the deaf. And I thought I could best achieve that aim with a method that was direct and undistorted and what is sometimes called, I think falsely, realistic. Ansel Adams, the late great photographer, trying to explain what his photographs were about, borrowed a word from his idol Stieglitz, the word equivalent. The photographic image was an equivalent of the feeling the artist had had when he took the picture, a form of transferable currency. I will accept that notion for fiction, too. And like Adams and Edward Weston and Imogen Cunningham and others of that San Francisco F-64 group, I prefer to avoid the double exposures, the imitation of painting, the tricky lighting, the artful compositions, and rely, insofar as I can, on found objects, natural lighting, and the clear statement of the lens, however good the lens is. Literature is a function of temperament, and thank God there are many temperaments, many kinds, and therefore many kinds of writers. I can speak only for my own, and after considerable acquaintance, I've determined that my temperament is quiet, receptive, skeptical, and watchful. I don't like big, noisy scenes in fiction or in life. I avoid riots and mass meetings. It would embarrass me to chase fire engines. I have a hard enough time making sense out of what my life hands me without going out hunting more exciting events. About 30 years ago in London, I got into a discussion with Martha Gellhorn, whom some of you may remember as Hemingway's third wife, a journalist, and a very, very able one. She told me with admirable frankness that though I wrote like a bird, I didn't write about anything that interested her. She had just returned from reporting some of those very early ugly events in the Sinai Desert, in the Gulf of Aqaba. And she thought I ought to go down there or somewhere like it, somewhere where something was happening, so that I could apply my talents to subjects worthy of them. And I'm afraid I offended her by saying that I thought that would be a kind of slumming. Not for her, because she was a journalist, that was her business, but for me, a fiction writer. I didn't think then, and I don't think now, that going out and committing experience in order to be able to write about it is any good way to make sense of my life. Unless I was irresistibly drawn to the Israeli-Arab conflict, unless I had some personal stake in it, unless I had some way of working it out and trying to bring it to an end, I thought that I ought, out of sheer sympathy, to leave that desert to the people whose commitments led them to shed their blood there. As with excitement and violence, so with self-conscious innovation. One observable fact about experimental writing, so-called, is that it so often turns out to be belated imitation of James Joyce. Another is that, like biological mutations, experimental forms and manners so seldom survive. As long as I'm saying what doesn't interest me, I might as well fill out the list. As I wouldn't be tempted to exploit the battles or troubles of strangers for my own purposes, or play innovator for the sake of being in on the latest fad, so I haven't ever been driven to thump what H.L. Mencken called the bourgeoisie, or foam in rage at the middle brows, or speak in thunder on the morning headlines. Not in fiction. Fiction's too important to be abused that way. In fiction, I think we should have no agenda except to try to be truthful. The shouters in thunder can roar from their podiums and pulpits, and I squeak from my corner. They speak to the deaf, but it takes good ears to hear me. For I want to be part of the common sound, the not too dominating element of the ambient noise. I'm old enough to have watched a lot of bright innovations and passionate causes fade out as ex-fads. Just as in my childhood, I watched a lot of hopeful short-grass homesteaders fade out and disappear before the hot winds and the drought. My family was among them. We turned tail and disappeared. And I never got over the faint residual shame of quitting. If we hadn't quit, I'd be stuck up there in the boondocks. It wouldn't have been very good, and yet there is a kind of shame in it. I admired the stickers, and I still do. Perhaps that is why, if I had the capacity to wish myself into any novelist who ever wrote, or any writer who ever wrote, I would be much more likely to pick, let us say, Henry Fielding's Tom Jones. I'd rather be the author of Tom Jones than of Lily's Euphues, or if you want to make the comparison a little fairer, Sterne's Tristram Shandy, which is an experimental novel of a very early kind. Funny, too, but lesser somehow, slighter. Those attitudes I've grown into pretty slowly. I started, as I just said, with the revolutionary and iconoclastic attitudes of the 20s, the time when I was in college. I vorted with the vorticists and imaged with the imagists. If I'd been able to get to Paris, I would have babbled with the Dadaists, I suppose, in the direction of total intellectual, artistic, and emotional disaffiliation. But there was one trouble. I'd grown up a migrant without history, tradition, or extended family in remote backwaters of the West. I never saw a water closet or a lawn till I was 11 years old. I never met a person with my surname, apart from my parents and brother, till I was past 30 years old. I never knew and don't know now the first names of three of my grandparents. My family either didn't tell me about any of that or couldn't have. Neither of my parents had finished grade school, and their uprooting was the cause of mine. My mother was sympathetic and supportive, and I think a saint, but she hadn't the tools to help me in many of the ways that I thought I needed help. And so, though I was susceptible to the dialectic of those who declared their independence of custom and tradition and the dead hand of the past, I had no tradition to declare myself independent of. And I never had felt the dead hand of the past in my life. If the truth were told, and it now is, I was always hungry to feel that hand on my head, to belong to some socially or intellectually or historically or literarily cohesive group, some tribe, some culture, some recognizable and persistent offshoot of Western civilization. If I revolted, and I had all the appropriate temptations, I had to revolt away from what I was and that meant towards something else. Tradition, cultural memory, shared experience, order. Even my prose, I suppose, felt the pull of agreed-upon grammar and syntax. I found it hard to run it right in non-sentences. Eventually, inevitably, I was drawn to what I most needed. I've been trying to make some kind of natural chaos into human order, trying to make sense of an ordinary American life for a long time now, more than 50 years, I suppose, in print. The West, in which I have spent most of my life, is not simply a retarded culture, though it once was. It's also a different culture from that of the literary capitals. A different culture with different drives and assumptions and prides and avenues of opportunity. School and college do sandpaper the roughness of the frontier off a little, but the frontier leaves its tracks. My first 15 years were migrant and deprived. My next 15, aspiring and academic and literary and deprived. And my last 50-odd, academic and literary, and not quite so deprived. It's progress, I suppose, of a sort. But I'm still the person my first 15 years made me. Without consciously intending to, I have written my life. The Big Rock Candy Mountain and Wolf Willow cover the years of frontier transients in the Dakotas, Washington, Saskatchewan, Montana, Utah, Nevada. The Preacher and the Slave about the IWW martyr Joe Hill, and Recapitulation, one of those growing up in the 20s novels, utilized the milieu of Salt Lake City, where I attended high school and college. About that place, I've also written histories, biographies, essays, and short stories. My 45 years in California are reflected in A Shooting Star, The Spectator Bird, All the Little Live Things, Some Stories, Angle of Repose, all of them utilizing houses and communities we lived in, and all of them inevitably revealing some fragments of myself. Angle of Repose does escape the personal to some extent. I borrowed a set of ancestors entire. But because I chose to tell that story in the first person, a lot of people have mistakenly recognized me in Lyman Ward's wheelchair. Of all the books I ever wrote, the latest novel, Crossing to Safety, is in some ways the most personal. It is, in fact, deliberately close to my own experience, opinions, and feelings, which are refracted through a narrator not too much different from myself. If the Big Rock Candy Mountain was an exorcism, and it was, Crossing to Safety is an attempt to understand and make sense of an important relationship in the lives of my wife and myself. A friendship that was rich and rewarding, but that left us fumbling for meanings and unsure of our emotional ground. I could also say, though I wouldn't press this, that it's an attempt to make the commonplace memorable, to communicate through the story of essentially uninflected lives all the pain, anguish, confusion, affection, sacrifice, the spontaneous pleasures, and the unanticipated catastrophes of the kind of living that most of us experience. It was a risky book to set before a reading public accustomed to spicier fare. There isn't a murder, a divorce, an illicit weekend, a gun, a liaison, a drug dream, a hot sex scene, even a wild party, isn't it? It deals with academics, who by definition are tepid and undramatic. Two young couples meet in the Depression in Madison, Wisconsin. One pair is rich, well-endowed, well-connected, and ambitious. The second is poor, orphaned, unconnected, and ambitious. The two men face similar problems, similar crises of promotion and tenure, which are endemic in the academic atmosphere. The wives are both pregnant. Nothing there to strain the acting powers of Clint Eastwood or Cher. Over the course of 30 years, these couples have children, suffer disappointment and illness, make do, put one foot after the other, survive, and are bent but not broken by their experience. Very different in their personalities, they remain close friends, as some people do. They don't always approve of one another. In fact, all three of the others have difficulty accepting the dominating personality of Charity Lang. But friendship outlasts disapproval, irritation, and matriarchal rigor. At the end of the book, and for that matter, at the beginning, since the front stage action takes only a day, Charity is on her way out of the lives that she loved and supported and dominated, and the others are left to survive, each according to his or her individual nature and condition, relying on whatever it is that in a long life they would not part with. The themes of the novel are love, friendship, and survival. The villains are willfulness, polio, cancer, and blind chance. The tensions are the tensions between and among people who love each other at least as much as they resent each other and resist each other. It's all very quiet. I intended it to be true. I wrote my guts out trying to make it as moving on the page as it had been to me while I was living and reliving it. My reason for writing that novel was not literary in the usual sense at all. We once had such friends as Sid and Charity Lang, and I tried to put them on the page without distortion, as far as I could do it, without exaggeration or heightening, because I kept trying, even after they were both dead, to understand them. I wanted to work out iconically the deepest and most troubling relationship of our lives, and at the same time, the most rewarding. I wanted to comprehend how a woman as charming as Charity Lang, a woman with every grace and every opportunity, affectionate, generous, thoughtful, intending only good, could at the same time be a domineering matriarch, a willful putter-downer of her husband, a tyrant sometimes to the children whose every first tooth and first disease she lovingly preserved in the family records, a woman who could say in anguish at the end, "My God, I've done so much harm," when all she had intended was affection and help. I wanted to understand how it might have been to be Charity's husband. By what combination of love, forgiveness, weakness, and self-deception, Sid Lang could have submitted to a lifetime of humiliating henpecking. I knew how it was to be Charity's friend, alternately baffled, angry, and disarmed. Only by writing her straight, as I knew her, could I get a clue on how it felt to be a member of her family. I suppose I wanted to justify those lives, bring them together, lay their ghosts. And in that effort, I wrote very close to memory and fact. I resisted whenever I felt myself wanting to adjust or improve or straighten out. I adopted a narrator who, though not myself, was not unlike me, a Western orphan, upward mobile, making his way. I used episodes from our actual experience because better than any invented episodes, they evoked the quality of our relationship. I reported the scene of Charity's going off to the hospital to die, exactly as my wife, who was present, reported it to me. I relied on memory for many scenes, the birth of Sally Morgan's child, the sailing mishap on Lake Mendota in Madison, the walking trip in the Green Mountains, the dinner party at which the four of us first became friends. Nevertheless, I was not running a sack race. I was not tightly bound, as I would have been in a history or biography or autobiography by explicit facts. I could expand or contract, unify, amplify, omit, according to some interior stabilizer that told me what was right here for this book, for this story, and what was not. What I wrote was a labor of love and bafflement, I suppose. so close to the facts that at first I didn't even intend to publish the book, because I knew everybody would recognize the people in it. But I had made more unconscious changes than I knew, and members of the family themselves helped to persuade me that what I had written was a novel, not a case history or a memoir, and so should be published. I didn't even emerge with any answers, prefabricated or earned. I emerged with as many questions as I had started out with. I still don't understand Charity Lang, or Sid Lang, who loved and endured her. But maybe something has changed. Once I had written them, they achieved a sort of inevitability. There they were in a book, characters made permanent, irrevocably what they were. And even I, who put them in the book, feel them somehow more substantial and less troubling than when they existed only in my life and my memory. So here we are back where we began. How to write a story, though ignorant or baffled. It takes something that is of real importance to you, something you have brooded about. You try to see it as clearly as you can, and to fix it in a transferable equivalent. All you want in the finished print is the clean statement of the lens, which is yourself, on the subject which has been absorbing your attention. Sure, it's autobiography. Sure, it's fiction. Either way, if you have done it faithfully, it ought to be true. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now we will try how to answer questions, though ignorant. If you will use the microphones, it may help me hear you better.
Mr. Stegner?
Yes.
Way up here at the top.
Way up there.
Okay. Here, in the middle, directly in front of you.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the...
Voices.
I'm
like Joan of Arc.
I'm interested in a description, if you could, of the mechanics of how you write, whether you write longhand or on a computer, whether you set hours in a day, how you take your vacations, that sort of thing.
I write the most uneconomically, wastefully, trial and errorly possible on an old manual Olympia typewriter, of which I have three for spare parts because nobody makes them anymore. I never learned how to use a computer, though I'm sure it would save me a lot of time. But one of the things that you get in the habit of doing if you've been typing since the age of 15, as I have, 60 or more years, 65, 67, You get so you bang with your three or four fingers very hard. You move the typewriter around, and there's a lot of satisfaction in it. It eases your hostilities and all the other things that you need easing. With the result that even on an electric typewriter, I can't use it. I hit it, and it's too hard, and suddenly it bursts out in a line of K's. It stutters at me. So I've never learned to use a computer. And I guess I don't mind that so much because I'm so used to the trial and error method that I'm used to retyping a thing seven or eight times instead of holding it on some screen while I doctor it. In the long run, it may even be better for the prose because it's been worked over more. Wendell Berry had a recent essay in which he said why he didn't use a computer. Because all it could do was make him write easier and faster, and he didn't need to write easier and faster. He wrote too easy and too fast already. And also, you can work when the power's down.
That was Wallace Stegner speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. His talk was part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1990. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers over the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. So join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in this series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.